Welcome to the Recovering from Religion podcast. We are a vibrant international community for those who have questions or doubts about their faith. On these podcasts, we talk to guests who have experienced harm from extreme religious beliefs, as well as experts who offer help, hope, and healing. And sometimes these people are one and the same. I am your host, Tim Reimel, along with my co-host, Bill Prickett. Hi, Bill.
Hey, Tim. How's it going?
Your sound waves are impeccable, Bill.
I've been working out.
And it shows. And I guess I should say Merry Christmas.
You absolutely should say that because I just got in from my duty of fighting the war on Christmas. And so the fact that you said that just makes my time on the battlefield that much better.
I was going to ask what side you're on.
I'm on the side of let's try not to be an asshole about it. Christmas is about not being an asshole. I think that's the way that we should approach it.
All right. Well, I'm with you there. I in our previous discussions off air, I went and looked this up because I was really curious about where this whole idea of the war on Christmas came from. And I was surprised to find out, maybe not so surprised knowing the history of this, but it was the Puritans who banned celebrations of Christmas in the 17th century because they felt it didn't go with their interpretation of the Bible.
And it was so interesting because they were so strict as far as the Bible is concerned, and they would be completely at odds with those today who are very strict in their beliefs of the Bible.
Right. Well, when it comes to Bible interpretation, it does change with the times.
What are you saying? The Bible, the same yesterday, today, and forever.
Depending on what denomination you're from, that is almost true. So I found this out too, right? So everybody associates this war on Christmas with Fox News. And again, there's a history to that. So I found out that there's a radio host by the name of John Gibson. In 2005, he was interviewed by Bill O'Reilly on, of course, Fox News. And he talked about his book, which was rather inflammatory. The title is The War on Christmas, How the Liberal Plot to Ban the Sacred Christian Holiday is Worse Than You Thought. And Gibson
said, I mentioned by name?
You could have been in one of the chapters.
Okay.
Gibson said that the book took on a life of its own. And he said the purpose of the book was primarily focused on an issue that rarely happens anymore, which is that educators and local officials were banning non-religious symbols like Santa Claus or Christmas trees out of the mistaken belief that displaying those symbols violated the Constitution. He said the book never dwelled on any political implications or saying happy holidays. It was Bill O'Reilly who took up the arms about Christmas being under attack because liberals had a political agenda to destroy these Christian American traditions. And just when you thought it was over, Sean Hannity just recently said that Christmas is now under siege. But it's not because people are refusing to say Merry Christmas. They've won that battle because of Trump.
Yes. That was one of his campaign promises.
Yes, and he kept it, by God.
Yes, he is bragging about the fact that we are now saying Merry Christmas so much more.
Right, because it never happened before, Donald Trump. And Sean Hannity's issue with this is that it was churches who presumably have a corner market on the phrase, you would think, but they're putting the baby Jesus in their nativity scenes in cages to point out the hypocrisy of the religious rights war on immigrants and asylum seekers. They can say Merry Christmas, but it's still Christmas is under siege because we're pointing out the purpose of Christmas.
Yeah, we're making Christmas a political statement.
Right.
I had not heard that from Hannity. It's probably the same reason I haven't won the lottery. I haven't bought a ticket.
So. I was going to say Sean Hannity is probably not in your Twitter feed.
No. And he rarely makes it onto my DVR. So, I had not heard that, but, I do remember that it was Bill O'Reilly who kind of promoted this. And then Sarah Palin wrote a book about it. And then I, in turn, wrote an article about Sarah Palin's book about it. I have seen the churches that are really using this to make a valid statement that it's very hypocritical if we want to talk about the entire nativity story and then put into practice these policies that do the very same thing of putting children in cages and separating parents and tear gassing families. It's a bit hypocritical. And so I can certainly see Hannity's point, but I disagree with his side of it.
Well, right. I mean, the whole thing has become just a massive hypocrisy against Christianity. And I always think about my parents. In fact, I had this discussion with them the other day, is that the Christianity that I was raised with was not this. The Christianity I was raised with, right, wrong, or indifferent, really was about love. And my parents have loved me and continue to love me. They loved me when I came out. They recently gave me this beautiful anniversary card for my husband and me. We've been married for 2 years, together for 9, and they gave us money. They're celebrating it. They are diehard evangelical Christians that just love people.
Right.
And you can't really argue with that.
No. And I don't remember any of this growing up, but I do think, and I've made this statement in several articles that I've written, that these kind of issues, they're straw men that are designed to focus on something that creates fear, because fear brings control. Fear brings in money. They can do fundraising with this. So I do think that we need a visible enemy to point to and say, this is the problem. The problem is people aren't saying Merry Christmas. The problem is immigrants. The problem is this caravan. And so you can point to something, and then you say, send me $20 and I'll help solve this problem.
That's Jimmy and Tammy Faye Baker all over again.
Yes, exactly. So that they can say, this is it, and send me your money and we'll solve it.
We are going to get right into the interview today. So it is almost Christmas time by the time this thing releases. And I hope everyone has the more politically correct happy holidays.
Happy holiday season's greetings. And it's a wonderful gift to us that you guys are out there listening to us. We appreciate the comments we're getting. We appreciate you being a part of what we're trying to do here.
So everybody have a wonderful and fantastic holiday season.
Yes.
We want to welcome Cass Midgley, who is our guest today. And Cass earned his master's in theological studies from Vanderbilt University in 2013 as an atheist. After leaving the church at age 38, Cass started the Everyone's Agnostic podcast in 2014, and the show now has over 500,000 downloads on it. Cass is also a humanist chaplain, and he counsels students on the Vanderbilt campus as the staff advisor to the Secular Student Alliance. And we are very excited to have Cass. So thank you for joining us.
Oh, yes, my pleasure.
And let's get started. So tell us a little bit about yourself.
All right. Well, I'm a white, straight, cisgender male. That's about it. No, I was born in Oklahoma, and I was raised Presbyterian, and I got involved in a Baptist church because they needed a drummer, and I was into music, and they're youth group was more vibrant than the Presbyterians, and they had more girls. And so I went over there, and it was the first time I was exposed to like the urgency and the ominous choice that you've got to make, because heaven and hell are in the balance. And mm-hmm. and I was like, oh my gosh, this is they never told me this at the Presbyterian church. And so I thought, okay, I'm on board, and started just really young, got very, very into it. And then it, just more and more, it just snowballed by the time I was in college. I was just all in, and that was my life. I had my life right in front of me. God was my life. I gave him my life. I said, here am I, send me. And so as a result, I forsook anything that was worldly or didn't have anything to do with evangelism. If it didn't please God, it wasn't God's will, I didn't care about it. I didn't care about money. I didn't care about career. And I just trusted him for everything. And I think, that's a recipe for disaster.
Well, so I'm curious, what did your family think when you got involved with that church?
Well, they thought I was over the top, and I'm sure they tried to rein me in, but I was... there's just something about knowing you're right. And hard to reach people like that. And I was that guy. And it took, you know, like I said in the bio there, 38, 39 years before I just allowed myself to go, what if I'm wrong?
Tim and I both come from a very conservative fundamental background. Tim was Pentecostal. I was Southern Baptist. So mm-hmm. when you talk about doing everything to please God, that rings familiar to both of us.
Yeah. I became a worship leader, youth pastor, and eventually a senior pastor of a church that I founded. And primarily the music was the thing that I did most as far as lead worship. And I'm sure you guys can relate, but countless hours and days and weeks and years of sitting with a guitar, standing with a guitar and piano and crowds of people, eyes closed, tears running down my face. Take my mm-hmm. heart, oh God, or, you know, here am I. And I just, I love you. And just, everything. He was everything, you know. I mean, there's even that song. He's everything to me, you know. You know, so it was like some of my guests have said before, it's not like finding out that there's no Santa Claus. It's like finding out that your mother never existed.
And if you keep singing those songs as a Baptist, I'll have to take up an offering.
Yeah, sure.
So I have a couple of questions. So what do you think led up to your such a dramatic shift, just to get, you know, getting involved with emotionalism? Were you in an emotional place at the time? What were you going through?
My father died when I was 17, and I was already mm-hmm. starting to get into Christianity, but I think it left a hole, you know, that God-shaped hole, but it was a daddy, mm-hmm. daddy-shaped hole. And of course, God's our Heavenly Father. So it was significant for me to feel loved. And I know myself, and I know really how much of a wretch I am. And so it just resonated with me that, the Bible says I'm a wretch. And God can see my deepest, darkest secrets, and yet he still loves me. And that just, I mean, that was just a winning combination for me that, okay, you acknowledge that I'm bad and you love me at the same time. I mean, what's not to love about that?
Were you evangelizing your family?
In fact, this is funny because now that I've turned around and gone the other way, I mean, I literally, begged them or, you know, worked on them for years. I got three older sisters. I'm the baby. And, you know, my mom and my three sisters eventually started coming to my church, and they got more and more devout as time went on. And all the while I'm kind of slipping backwards and now just full blown atheist activist even. And they in my little hometown where I was a minister are confused as hell. They really are. And they look at me and, you know, even when I was there and I was radical, there was a lot of judgment about how radical I was. And now that I'm radical in the other direction, and I get it. I mean, that's flip-flopping. And I mean, even my wife was a little bit thrown whiplashed, you know, by the change. I mean, it didn't happen overnight, but, you know, there is a degree in which I think she's waiting to see what I'll believe in next.
Yeah, we've seen this before. Let's go. What's next?
Mm-hmm. As a music minister with all those emotions, and I can relate to you. So I was a music minister for, you know, during that 25 years I was in ministry, and I was a black gospel musician. So I traveled the black gospel choirs, played in different venues, and the emotion of those feelings is so intense that they are mm-hmm. as much a part of your experience with God as Bible reading. How did you separate that out? How did you start to look or start to kind of take that apart and look at what was real and what wasn't real?
Yeah. You know, I guess there's always just that dull hum in the back of your mind, even when you're devout, that it's like, you know, we could be talking to the ether here. And it just grew and swelled. And I know that one thing for me was I began to deconstruct piece by piece. So I think maybe the first thing to go was I didn't believe in hell. I became like an annihilationist, you know, to where, you know, Even John 3:16 says, God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son, and whosoever believeth in him shall not die. So it's only the believers that get to live forever. And it's, if you don't believe, then you just become worm food and you die. And so as opposed to torturing you forever. So anyway, hell was the first thing to go. Then inerrancy of scripture. I just couldn't. I mean, there wasn't any point. I felt like the church was worshiping the Bible.
And they are.
Yes. And yes. So I was like, you know what? You know, the word became flesh. The word's still not paper, you know. So, but that got me in trouble, you know, even as a founding pastor of a church, you know, one of those storefront churches that we met in a skating rink after a while. And
we did that at one church I was part of.
It wasn't in Ponca City, Oklahoma, was it?
No, it was actually in Birmingham, Alabama.
Okay. Well, you set up chairs and PA system every week, right?
Yes.
Yeah, what a mess. But anyway.
Oh, it was.
So inerrancy, I eventually didn't believe in the substitutionary atonement scapegoat nature of Jesus's death, and that he was more of a political dissident than he, you know, than there had to be some other reason other than just, you know, God beating him up because God really wants to beat me up and I'm going to beat up my son instead. And after a while, it just didn't make any sense. I don't think it ever did, but I had so much faith. You know, I just, you know, the Bible, you're supposed to trust God. Mm-hmm. You're supposed to lean not on your own understanding. And so I didn't. I was like, oh, yep. All right. That don't make any sense to me, but God's on the throne and he's got this. You know, that's what they say to themselves today. We know.
Oh, yeah. We did. Yeah. I did. Yeah.
Well, so the killer was 9/11. Mm-hmm. And I was one of those guys that, and you know, to this day, I'm not to this day. But as I get older, I give less and less fucks about stuff. I just pick my battles better. Whereas young and zealous, I just was on a mission from God, and there wasn't anything more important than me being willing to do anything for God. Like Abraham was willing to kill his son. You know, there were some Old Testament guys that just knocked down Ashtoreth poles, and they were like, you know, it was kind of a machoism of I'll do anything for God, and that's the way I was, and I had. You know, I had T-shirts made up that was a ministry that I had, and on the front of it, it said, whatever it takes, which is a end justifies the means type mentality, which is dangerous as fuck. And that's what those guys did on 9/11, is they literally thought they were maybe doing God's will. I mean, how can you fly a plane into a building killing thousands of people and in your heart and mind, or at least what I don't know what was in their hearts and minds, but I'm assuming that, you know, they're like, Allah Akbar, this is praise God, all glory to God. This is, and they, if that's going on in their minds, those guys' devotion and bravery put mine to shame. And I thought, is this where I'm going? You know, is radical Christianity eventually willing to do anything? I mean, obviously, historically they did the Crusades.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So the more devout you get, I mean, you know, so the closer you get to God and the more devout you get, the more dangerous you become. And that just was like a point of diminishing returns or something.
So where did this level of faith come from initially? Why do you think you, I mean, I don't know your personality. So are you kind of an all-in kind of guy?
Oh, yeah. All in.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. And I think that it was, like I said, without a dad, you know, it was like, I don't know, that lion, that story where this, what was it, a mouse or something took a thorn out of a lion's paw. And yes. For them, from then on, the lion is devout to the mouse. And I think God saved me. God gave me a daddy, and I got your back. And if I deny him before men, he'll deny me before my father. I'm not ashamed of the gospel. I'm Cass Midgley, and I'm a man after God's own heart. And when he looks down at me, he is proud of this guy. I mean, it's just that drive to make daddy proud just transferred over, I think, to God. And so, yeah, I was all in.
What was it like being a member of Cass Midgley's church?
Well, we worshiped for 45 minutes, you know, the first week right off the bat. And that's really, honestly, that's part of what drew people. I got to a church where I was kind of just the worship leader, and the church tripled in size within a couple of years, and it was mostly because of the music. So music was a big deal. And, you know, I'll tell you what, the people, and even to this day, this is going to sound boastful, but I love the people the types of people that rally around me. And I know that sounds arrogant, but honestly, it's a testimony of something. And those people, I love those people. Now, when you're going back to the church and you're asking what's a church service like or what's a church like, these are intelligent people. They're kind. They are fun. I didn't have a bad experience with the church that drove me out. I left the church kicking and scratching. I mean, it was all doctrinal for me. And eventually, though, if you question the doctrines, then those people do turn on you. Yeah. They did turn on me. I don't know. To answer your question, it was just a great group of people. I looked forward to it every Sunday. It was, you know, if we had today, even in a secular setting, if we had a weekly meetup in a place where there was, you know, coffee and music and talks and small groups and hugs and stuff, I mean, what's not to like?
When you started transitioning, can you kind of explain what was happening in your church at that time? What were you saying to people? What were you holding back? What did you go through?
Well, not only did I leak out every now and then, I mean, just enough, I hate to use the word dog whistle, but I mean, there was just, I wasn't trying to send a message. In fact, I was trying to not send a message, but it leaked out enough to where the hardline men, and I do say men, I know there was probably some women too, they picked up on inferences that I didn't respect the Bible enough, the inerrancy, and I was starting to take liberties to say, I don't believe in hell, you know, and you don't get to choose that, you know, you don't get to cherry pick the Bible. And when I started cherry picking it, they picked up on it. So there was a lot of problem there, but the real deal, and this is where I messed things up. And the thing about my experience with the church and Christianity specifically, its stance on sex. I had a babysitter messed with me when I was 5, and I don't remember the details, but I just know that my sexuality, you know, that switch was flipped at a very early age, much earlier than, you know, probably should be, right? And I just remember being like 6 years old and having sexual fantasies about Ginger on Gilligan's Island. So I was already a very sexually driven minded person at, you know, 6 years old. And so it just followed me. And obviously as you cross over into puberty, it just lights up. So you're 18, 19, you know, and I'm a highly sexualized person. And at the time, because of Christianity, I was ashamed of it. And I was horrified of it and just kind of always suppressing it. And, you know, don't think of a pink elephant. Don't think of a pink elephant. Don't think of a pink elephant, you know. And I think now we know psychologically that whatever you fight, you know, grows. What you think about, you bring about. And so it literally backfires on the whole system. And there's no point. I mean, so what happened was, is this, just like I think with Catholic priests or anything else, anytime that you dam up human sexuality, which is a river powerful as hell, might be one of the most powerful forces on the planet, is the human sexual drive. And it's evolutionary, right? It's survival of the fittest. It's adaptation. It's those that reproduce themselves. That's the genes that we inherited. Or these are the people that like to fuck. That's whose genes we got. You know, because if you didn't like to fuck, you didn't reproduce, your seed died, your gene stopped there. So anyway, evolutionarily, here we find ourselves. So I suppressed it, and I was a teacher at a Christian high school. And after hours, I looked at porn on the computer, and it was discovered by somebody, and I was fired from the school. I was asked to step down from the pastoral position at the church for as a disciplinary season for 6 months. And it was in that process that I think that was almost like, you know, you're going to show me the door. Then it's then that I began to allow myself to think for myself. And I was tired. I think I was exhausted.
In your bio, when you talk about your struggle with your faith, you use some interesting metaphors. You talk about it in terms of the matrix.
Mm-hmm.
You talk about it in terms of taking the red pill.
Yeah.
I found both of those metaphors very, very interesting and descriptive.
Well, you've seen the movies, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I guess it's the Wachowski brothers, or used to be brothers. Now they're sisters.
Yeah, they're both sisters now.
But they, man, I mean, they just, it just was, I love that kind of stuff. I love philosophy. I love metaphors. And I think it just resonates with me that there's a real world going on here. You know, now that I'm out of the church and not a Christian anymore, I don't know. I mean, I was so submerged in the subculture of Christianity and the big, dark, mean darkness of the outside the village, if you will, the M. Night Shyamalan movie, outside the fence. You know, there's another metaphor, but outside the gate, you know, that scary world. And, you know, now that we're out here, it's a wonderful world. And it's beautiful. And so is my sexuality. And so is breathing in and out. I mean, like, this world has been operating exactly as it would if there were no God for billions of years. And the whole mind fuck, or the whole hypnosis that you're under as a Christian, is you're in the matrix. You're connected to an artificial machine that is, you know, keeping you alive, but you're not alive. It's keeping you, you know, heart pumping, but going to church every week just to stay on fire, if you will, or get fed. And, and, you know, because if you didn't go every week, you know, eventually you would, that little myth that you're keeping alive by artificial means will die, and your eyes will be open. I love these metaphors in the Bible and how much they're actually true of the opposite, and that the shackles come off your eyes. I mean, we were lost and now we're found. You know, I was lost.
You know what I find interesting is when you're in the church, everything is focused on the church. And as, you know, being part of the evangelical church, there was not a lot of evangelism going on. We went there Sunday mornings and Sunday nights and Wednesdays and choir practice. And then on the weekends, we had the church cleanup day. It was all about the church. It was all about keeping the church alive. It was all about staying in fellowship. And there really was not anything, at least in my experience, we didn't do anything outside of have a small food closet if the homeless person came in.
Yeah.
There really was nothing going on to help the community. It was almost like an anti-social justice movement.
Yeah, navel gazers and introverted, and it's an incestuous place because it's feeding in on itself. And but if you will, that shame on you, you know, for not being more outside. And so it just becomes another source of shame, because the next visiting evangelist that comes along, he's going to stand up there and wag his finger and say, "What are you guys doing for your own city?" And just becomes another source of shame.
Well, and I pastored a church for 11 years.
Oh, wow.
And we actually did outside stuff. We had an inner city ministry.
Yeah, I did door to door.
Yeah, we did. I taught evangelism. We went door to door. I took kids out to the mall. We taught reading at underprivileged schools. And then we faced another problem. The people that we would meet on the street then wanted to come to mm-hmm. church. And of course, that causes all kinds of issues of
should oh God, yes.
those kinds of people in our mm-hmm. services. So
yeah.
it is an interesting conflict that we're either so introspective that we lose ourselves in ourselves, the church becomes a self-perpetuating organization, or then we start bringing in the masses. And we're not compatible yeah. with them.
Oh my God.
We had gypsies. Yeah, we had gypsies in our service. And you're right. In fact, it got so bad that we started doing separate services. My pastor and I started doing separate services for the gypsies so they wouldn't intertwine with the regular church.
Yeah. And it's another source of shame, because if you find yourself uncomfortable with certain people that you're supposed to love, and it's not true. Actually, there's a lot of people. I mean, I would say there's 5 people in this world that I'm supposed to love, and the rest of y'all can go, you know. I mean, I'm serious. I'm not supposed to be friends and lovers with everybody. And yet it's another source of shame if I'm not, even as, you know, I don't know. There's just no end to how much the world of God, the world that God rules and judges, and there's no end to the sources of shame that just keep a person down, 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 chin down, no pride. Pride is a sin. No agency, because you can't think for yourself. You got to turn your mind over to God, etc. And I don't know. I just can't hardly think of something that is other than just like an intentional brainwashing concentration camp in Korea or something during the war. I mean, like where they're doing it on purpose. bar that kind of treatment right here, mainstream America is doing it to human beings every day, suppressing, binding their prisoners in their own fear and shame. And it's going on every corner of at least this town and a lot of southern towns. And it's given us things like Trump. Just, I'm sorry, but to get political, but it's yes, our credulity and our stupidity because of the lobotomy that we're getting from, you know, this construct is just, yes. I was suspicious 20 years ago in ministry. Every now and then, I remember one time in particular, it was a weekday. So I was in my office at the church. It was one of the times in my life where I was a full-time associate pastor. I'm in my office. Maybe I'm doing a Bible study or something. And I every now and then I would get these inklings that I'm working for the enemy, I was still thinking that Jesus was God, and Jesus was the one telling me the church is evil. The church is evil. And then I would like slap myself in the face and say, no, it can't be true. And I would say that the thing that kept me in the church for so long and kept me, you know, going back on those types of honest thoughts and those moments of transparency with myself, honesty. The reason I went back, the number one reason I went back, is I just couldn't align, or I couldn't compare myself to the juggernaut that is Christianity. 2,000 years, cathedrals as tall as the Empire State Building all over the country. Billions and billions of dollars, billions of books written, I went to seminary, whole libraries full of research on John 2 verse 6, like laser focused research and study, and millions of people and millions of buildings and millions of dollars and hospitals built in the name of Jesus. And here's just little old me saying, I think it's wrong. I think it's evil. I can't compete with the juggernaut. And so I just thought it must be me. It must be me that's wrong, because, you know, all of this. And it kept me in prison until I finally said, no, I actually think all you motherfuckers are brainwashed and I'm right.
Well, and I do think that fear is so controlling.
Absolutely.
Fear is a great way to control people. It's a great way to get them back to church. It's a great way to give their money, to get them to vote the way you want them to vote. I think fear is, and then I think in what you were saying, our identity gets caught up in, especially those of us in the ministry. How do I think of myself outside of what I'm doing right now? Because I am what I do. So it's a very, very difficult thing. I have a question for you.
Well, let me say one thing about what you just said, because there is a lot of people that are scratching their head right now. And I mean, from articles in Time magazine, everybody in the secular world, all over the map, Americans are just dumbfounded as to how did Trump appeal to evangelicals. And it's a mystery to a lot of people. But I think what you just said just nails it, because, all right, Christians are used to not only the language of fear, but being controlled by fear. It's what they know. It's the neural pathways in their brain are wired to not only be driven and motivated by fear, but to feel good about it and actually not even like see it as a negative. That this being a child of God, being in the army of God, marching in step with God's word, being an obedient good boy and girl for God is a good thing. And it's how they live, and it's the water they're swimming in, and it's the language and the construct mm-hmm. of fear.
Yes.
So that's what they're used to, right? So here comes a guy, and his whole deal is the immigrants are coming, you know, the sky is falling, and he's just creating fear, fear, fear. And guess yes. why? Guess how it resonates with them? It's the language of God. Mm-hmm. It's the language of the Bible. It's what they're used to hearing. And so it's that familiar voice.
Yeah, exactly.
And they're like, oh, he's one of us. And how blind they are to his morality and just as a horrible, you know, human yeah. being. Oh, he's one of us. And like zombies, they walk right into it and loving every minute, patting themselves on the back and patting him on the back. And there you have it.
Growing up in the Baptist church and hearing preachers, I the campaign was going on, I said, this man represents everything that my pastors used to use as
yeah, absolutely.
Something we should avoid. His character, his morality, his behavior, his ethics, right. his actions, his everything. These are examples yep. that we should avoid. He would have been the illustration mm-hmm. of what not to do. And then suddenly he is the epitome of all that it represents. And of course, I live here in Dallas, and one of the largest churches here is one of his huge backers and supporters. Mm-hmm. So I hear that. But what you were saying, I during the campaign, I remember a scene from one of my all-time favorite movies, The American President, written by Aaron Sorkin, who wrote West Wing, and I just think he's a god.
I do too.
And that final scene where President Andrew Shepard is talking about his opponent, and he says, all he will do is point to people and say, that's your problem. That's your problem. Those people are your problem. But he won't offer any solutions. He just wants you to make you afraid.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought of that throughout the campaign and for the last couple of years. It's all about pointing at somebody saying, that's your enemy. To make you afraid of them.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So,
again, I do have a question for you, but we're going to take a break and we'll be right back.
Recovering from Religion is funded by those who believe in what we do. We invite you to support us with a monthly or one-time donation. Go to our website, recoveringfromreligion.org, and click on the donate button for instructions. On the website, you'll also find an extensive database of resources, including links, articles, and videos. We offer 24-hour phone and chat line support, along with the links to meetup groups in 20 communities around the U.S. With our secular therapy project, we can connect you with a professional who offers evidence-based, non-religious treatment. Our partner therapists understand the complexities of rethinking or leaving your faith. Finally, Recovering from Religion is an entirely volunteer-run organization. If you're interested in being a volunteer with us, please visit recoveringfromreligion.org and look for the volunteer tab.
In your bio, you refer to yourself as an atheist. Mm-hmm. Your podcast says everybody's agnostic. So talk about the distinction that you're making here.
Yeah.
I'm assuming I'm not the only person to ask this question.
Oh, yeah. You're not the first one by any means. We had David Silverman in this studio live because he was in Nashville visiting for something. And he took me to task on the air, you know, because he just wants everybody to use the word atheist and the word agnostic is just divisive and it's confusing and you need to start using the word atheist and you know all of that. So the thing about it is the truth is when it comes to God and by that I mean like. Just the office or the notion that whatever that word means, that it means, if it means the origins of life, the overall entity. Now, if you want to say Jehovah, yeah, I don't believe Jehovah exists. You know, I can't say, you know, for certain. But anyway, the point is that if you're going to come to the table and we're going to talk about theology, it's going to benefit the conversation for you to say, I don't know. I mean, anytime you bring certainty to a conversation, there is no conversation to be had, because at least whoever is certain is not listening. So, you can't call it a conversation, and you can't call it intercourse. I mean, that's what conversation is social intercourse. And so you're not engaging if you're not at least acknowledging that I could be wrong. And so it was just a way to say, let's start the conversation by admitting that everyone's agnostic when it comes to these types of existential, ineffable questions and such.
I noticed in your bio, too, that you said you got your master's in theological studies from Vanderbilt in 2013 as an atheist. So, what the hell, Cass? What the hell?
So, what happened was that I had been in ministry for almost 20 years and never had a day of any kind of biblical or theological training. And so, I wanted to write books critical of Christianity, and I felt like that I wouldn't have any credentials. I'm kind of a snob when it comes to nonfiction. If you're going to write a nonfiction book, nobody should really care if you're pulling it out of your ass. Now, there's a couple of exceptions. There's a couple of exceptions, but I mean, as far as people theorizing, and that's kind of fun to listen and read people's theories, because that is pulling it out of their ass. You know, there's no research on that kind of stuff. But in general, I wanted to have some credentials to write critically about theology, and so that's why I did it.
That's why I write novels.
Right. And I didn't end up writing the book, and I may never write the book. I started a podcast instead. But but I think it helps. I think it's helped the podcast, you know, for me to be able, you know, if somebody's listening, and at the time my co-host was Bob Pondillo, who has a PhD in mass communications, and he's an avid reader, and he actually went to seminary for a year himself, and we're both infatuated with religion and philosophy, and I've got this master's degree. And so if somebody, you know, tuned into the radio, to the podcast, and they were like, well, who do these guys think they are? Well, he's a PhD and he's got a master's in theology. That's who. Mm-hmm.
So what was that experience like being in a master's program? Were people liberal? Were they conservative? What was the makeup of the class?
Well, Vanderbilt Theological is very liberal. The dean of the college is a lesbian black woman. So you can get an idea of how outside the box they are as far as evangelical. They're primarily Methodist in the student body that were my colleagues there were primarily Methodist. United Church of Christ, I don't know, outside of those two denominations, I'm not really sure. But there was a few of us that were non-believers, and that we weren't getting the degree to go into ministry. But I'll tell you this, what I came away with was there are people of faith, of Christian faith, that I respect, and they know that Jesus wasn't the Son of God any more than us. They realize there's probably no afterlife. I mean, you know, like they really have cherry picked it. And of course, the next question is, well, why even, you know, drag it along if it's that, you know, impotent? And I think that's a valid question, but that's them. You know, that's their right. And every now and then I'll refer to a scripture, or I'll refer to something that Jesus said, but I also refer to something that Aesop's fable said, or something. You know, I mean, like, I don't know. It just was a experience in liberal theology. These people care about the poor. These people are all about social justice. They took the Jesus of social justice and, you know, the Jesus that loved the poor, and they took that to the nth degree, and that was their emphasis. Their emphasis was not salvation. Their emphasis was, you know, not legislating morality or some kind of theocracy that most evangelicals are for. These people were just about loving the poor and taking care of the homeless and et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, I'd be a dick to criticize that, really, in a way.
and I appreciate that because I am an active member of a UCC. Mm-hmm. And I consider myself a person of faith. I'm not a person mm-hmm. of certainty, not like, you know, from where I've come from. It's certainly not. And I appreciate the fact that you allow that kind of individual mm-hmm. latitude. It is not something that I, especially coming from my background where I used to teach evangelism, I do not mm-hmm. debate it. It's just something that's very personal to me. It's something that mm-hmm. Is part of, but it is more of what you talked about. It's the social aspect. We are very involved in social justice and the poor and the homeless and those kinds of things. We're very involved in. We have a black gay pastor, yes, and a lesbian pastor. So it we're very inclusive, and for me, the community is much more important to me these days than
sure.
the doctrines and yeah. all of those things that I let yeah. go of years ago.
And well, it should. And I think you're right as far as, hey, this is my faith. This is me. Get out of my face. It's none of your business. And I think if more people would feel that way, and we really have a separation of church and state, and it just stay in your heart, you know, it's your heart and mind. You believe whatever you want, you know. And I've had I think at least 15 Christians on the show over the years, all of which I love and respect. I mean, mm-hmm. David Dark is a guy here in Nashville. He's written some books and I follow him on Twitter, and oh my God, I have so much respect for him. He's like a hero to me. And he is a devout Christian in his own way. Like I said, he doesn't believe in hell and he doesn't believe in substitutionary atonement. And,
right. Yeah. Hell, I'm like you. Hell for me was one of the early on, after I kind of began to pull away and my theology and my faith and my practices began to change. I had one of my former church members come to me and said, "It sounds like you don't believe in hell anymore." And I said, "If you go back and listen to all the sermons I did in the 11 years I was your pastor, mm-hmm. I never preached on hell. Because I always had an issue with it.
Well, good.
I always, even as a fundamental evangelical pastor,
yeah.
hell and it bothered should. And the I'll, hell
let's,
out of me.
Let's touch on this for a second because it's a big deal. I think that we can't just flippantly, and that's actually the problem, I think, with evangelicals is that, like, my mother, well, actually, she doesn't believe it. I can't use her as an example. But if you know some people that are just sweethearts that are Christians, and if you were to ask them, do you believe in hell? And if they say yes, there is mm-hmm. no bigger compartmentalization than that right there. Because there is not a more evil concept than eternal torture. Guess what? After 10,000 years, you're just getting started. I can't stand 1 second of pain. So I'm a smoker, and sometimes I'll mm-hmm. you know, accidentally touch my skin with the end of my cigarette, and it hurts like hell. And I'm like, oh, and it'll hurt for maybe depending upon how long it's stood there, it'll hurt for a couple of days. Well, what if that's all I've felt for eternity? And that's not just in one little spot on my arm. Who knows? Yes. What this concept is. Now, I don't think it's biblical. I don't think a good God would ever even conceive of it. But Christians believe it, and their imagination can do whatever they want to with it. But if they hold that as a truth in their hearts, it can do nothing but corrupt their consciences, their ability to be empathic to their neighbor. It can make them cold and hard and because if they can be neighbors, and like, let's say they're out walking the dog and they run into their neighbor who they know is not a Christian, and they can talk about the weather with somebody that they know is going to be tortured forever. How fucked up is that? How twisted is that in your mind? So just the mere yes. concept of hell. I mean, in this show alone, I've gotten all fired up all over again about how evil Christianity is. What you guys did this to me.
I feel like I should apologize, but I think hell was this hell. Hell mm-hmm. is another of the fear factors for sure. that control people.
It's evil
because that's what we were told for so long. As gay people, we were told, and throughout my church life, we were told that if we didn't go out and witness to people, we might as well pick them up and throw them into the lake of fire.
The number one thing that I would recommend and that helped me was YouTubing. Just YouTubing people giving either lectures. I'm not a big fan of debates per se, but there's a lot of stuff out there, and especially this guy, Christopher Hitchens. He's now deceased. He died about 6 years ago, I think. He's a British guy, one of the most brilliant, articulate people I've ever heard. And he was a little rough around the edges, and he certainly was, you know, when you're a genius, I think I've seen this before, and it was true of Bill Gates when he was in college. It was said of him that he just had no personal hygiene because he didn't care, and he was too busy inventing DOS or something. But this is the way Hitchens is. He's very unkept. Like, his hair is oily, and he's overweight, and he smokes and drinks whiskey. And I think he did die of probably, you know, lung cancer or something. No, it was some kind of throat cancer. So he didn't take care of himself. He's a genius. That all aside, one of the things that he did that I'd never seen anybody do, especially my view of atheists was like, you know, Anton LaVey or, you know, some Dracula-looking character. And they hated My Best Friend, and they flipped the bird to Jesus on the cross, and Jesus was gone to the cross for them, and they just pissed on him. And so they were evil, and they could be nothing but evil and morally deplorable. That was my image of atheists. And I started watching Hitchens. He's the guy that wrote the book, God Is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything. He took the moral high ground in his conversations with Christians. There's a couple of times where you'll see him confronting a Christian. He's like, shame on you, you know, for concepts like hell and for, you know, shaming LGBTQ or whatever. I mean, just I'd never seen or imagined that an atheist could take the moral high ground from a Christian. And boy, that was a big deal for me. That set my deconversion with rocket boosters into the stratosphere, because that's the thing is, what led me to Jesus? The love and the desire to be right and good and fair and true and compassionate. Jesus attracted me because of all of those things. And my pursuit of love took me to Jesus, and it took me past Jesus. And right now, I'm a more loving person. My friends are more loving. My atheist friends are far more loving and kind and genuine than my Christian friends ever were or ever capable of because of this stuff.
I have some of those atheist friends as well.
Yeah. So let me ask you this, because you mentioned on your website about you see nihilism as a best practice of theism. Yeah. What does that mean?
Actually, did you say nihilism?
Nihilism, yeah.
No, it's atheism. Atheism's the best practice of theism.
Well, in your website, it says you mentioned atheism and even some nihilism are the best practices for theism.
That makes sense. Yeah, I'll throw in a little bit of nihilism, but just to say outright nihilism is the best practice of theism. I disagree with that. But and here's the thing about atheism being the best practice of theism, and I'll throw in a little nihilism, and that is, if you're God and you got all these humans down here running around with finite minds, they're really limited in what they can fathom. And yeah, they're doing their best, and science has taken them places that, you know, every day they're getting further and further along in their scope of understanding and knowledge. But for the most part, we're very limited in what we can know. And so here, going back to the humility of agnosticism, just saying, you know what, there's no way that I can understand God. There's no way I can speak on behalf of God. There's no way I can tell you, my neighbor, what he likes or dislikes. How would I know? I don't have a hotline to God. Nobody has a hotline to God. Nobody knows a goddamn thing about God. It's all just man-made, made-up constructs and pulling stuff out of our ass and projecting our own likes and dislikes onto the God of our choice and the God of our making. So let's stop. Let's all stop. Let's all stop pretending we know God. Let's ignore God and turn our energies on to loving each other, fixing our own problems. Let's not call on the heavens to solve cancer. Let's go back to the laboratory. Let's not call on the heavens to, you know, feed the children in Africa. Let's go do it ourselves. Let's forget God exists and let's just be atheist practitioners of humanity and humanism and let's just do this. And a good God would love that. A good God would celebrate that. A good God would say, thank you. You finally started ignoring me and started loving and looking to each other. So atheism's the best practice of theism. Now, where nihilism comes in is kind of that thing where I said a second ago that the older I get, the less fucks I have to give. I pick my battles better. I don't feel like I'm the savior of the world. I do feel like that life is truly, in fact, meaningless in itself. There is no extant meaning to life. If there is any meaning, it's what I give it. And in a way, that's kind of me making stuff up. And that's okay because I have to live and cope and not kill myself and be happy. And so if I say, you know what, I get a whole lot of joy and meaning and purpose and a sense that I matter by watching my children develop as young adults. I could say to myself, wow, I did that. And I can pat myself on the back and I can say, you know, had I not existed, they wouldn't exist. And so my existence matters because they matter and they're beautiful and they're probably going to have kids and they're going to have kids. And wow, I really did something on the earth. I mean, it really was just procreation, but no, I sowed into them wisdom and knowledge and taught my son how to fish or something, you know? So anyway, we give ourselves meaning, but there is no extant meaning. And I think a little bit of nihilism, a little bit of acknowledgement of, you know what, all of this is in vain. I think Ecclesiastes is actually a brilliant book.
It is. It really is.
Right? It's all in vain. It's a chasing after the wind, especially American consumerism, like the path, you know, the we're going to get more toys. Yeah. We're going to get happier and happier with bigger yachts and more helicopters on them. And it's just a myth. And so nihilism in the sense that, honestly, I don't matter. You don't matter. None of this matters. And so eat, drink, and be merry for tomorrow we die. I mean, I think that's actually good advice. I think a degree of nihilism can help you cope because if you feel like everything matters, then it's just overwhelming. That's all.
If everything matters, then nothing matters. And that's, you know, that cliche. But there is this, we can't, it is a coping mechanism for us to kind of at some point say, I can't deal with that right now.
And that's okay.
I understand that's going on. Yeah, I do what I can do here and that kind of thing. Before we wrap up, I want you to give us information, how people can listen to your podcast, because I think they should. I listen to some and they should listen to you as well. So tell us how to get there.
Well, and I have some friends who, and former guests of the show that man the hotlines of RFR. And they do occasionally, they're talking to somebody who's struggling. And they'll say, you know, here's a list of podcasts you can listen to that'll make you feel less lonely. A lot of people on their deconversion experience feel crazy. They're scared. They're losing friends and family. And so listening to other stories is a very powerful thing. I mean, it just took off like gangbusters when we started this show 4.5 years ago. And all we do is we interview people you don't know about a subject no one wants to talk about. And that's, you know, leaving God, leaving faith. And so it's just everyone'sagnostic.com. There's a link to the show there. There's iTunes, Stitcher, Spreaker, anywhere podcasts are broadcast, you can find it. Everyone's Agnostic.
And we'll have a link on our podcast as well where they can find you.
Thanks for joining us, Cass. This was enlightening for me. I actually learned a lot, and I liked some of your explanations for that. So Cass Midgley, thank you for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure, and thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So everybody have a great day. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
This podcast is one part of Recovering from Religion. We invite you to visit our website at recoveringfromreligion.org to find other valuable resources and to make a donation that will support all the work we do here. If you have questions for either of us, or if you have suggestions for a future topic, or if you think you'd like to be a guest on a show, tell us about that in an email at podcast@recoveringfromreligion.org. Again, thanks for listening to this episode of the Recovering from Religion podcast.